For some time now, we've used the third CD of each Breast Cancer Update program to experiment with new approaches to audio education, and last year we produced a special fellows rounds with my mentor, Dr. Charles Vogel, where the patients themselves are interviewed. We found a much greater audience than fellows for this pilot project, but most importantly, we had another innovative platform to evaluate and modify. We're back again with Dr. Vogel, and as in the first program, the number of patients with metastatic breast cancer. Not wanting to try to tell my teacher what to do, I pretty much left up to Chuck whom he picked, and the result was, as always, highly informative of the art and science of the clinical management of patients in this very difficult situation, in this case, younger women, all of whom have parented minor children while dealing with metastatic breast cancer. The first patient is an extraordinary example of the potential benefits of participation in a clinical trial. In 1995, at the age of 32, this woman entered the pivotal trial evaluating trastuzumab and chemotherapy in metastatic HER2-positive disease.
At the time that she developed bone metastases, we put her on a protocol, and she was randomized to Taxol with or without trastuzumab.
And at that point, I don't know if you recall sort of what was thought about trastuzumab and where it was at that point.
At the time of the pivotal trial, nobody really knew what to think about trastuzumab, including Genentech. And probably one of the more interesting stories was during the conduct of the pivotal trial, one of the most fun moments of my career was when I went to California, met with Steve Schack, and we had patients on the 649 clinical trial of single-agent trastuzumab at that time. And I was a skeptic. I had lived through the era of Ciparvim and BCG, and to me this was another immunotherapy. And my first five patients on that trial did not respond until a patient came in a wheelchair and she had liver mets and bone mets and was horrible. And she had an absolutely phenomenal response. Then I had another couple of responses and I went out to California and met with Steve Schack, who was the third person in charge of the pivotal trial. And I was talking to him in his office. And he grabbed the head of Genentech walking in the hall and said, "You tell him what you just told me." Because they were trying to figure out whether they wanted to build another factory in order to produce enough trastuzumab to complete the trials in a reasonable time frame. And
yeah, I mean, it's all well and good to think about, you know, all the dollars that are going out for biologic therapy, but in the beginning, somebody had to invest some serious money.
Correct. And they really didn't know what they had. They were waiting for this pivotal trial to tell them. And I said, you know, pivotal trial, no pivotal trial. You have a biologic that's causing responses, that is inducing responses in patients with liver metastases. I mean, this is incredible.
So let's just fast forward to this patient up to the present. I mean, actually, obviously, she's diagnosed with mets in 1995. It's 13 years later. She walks in and looks completely healthy. So I know there's been a lot of details, but can you sort of fast forward to like the last year or two?
She was estrogen receptor positive. And the longest response that she had was actually a response that lasted 7 years to Farostan plus Herceptin after she had undergone an oophorectomy. So we oophorectomized her and then put her on Farostan plus Herceptin, and she stayed in remission for 7 years from 1998 to 2005. Before that time, she had gone on the pivotal trial, progressed, and then she was put on the extension trial where we could treat her with trastuzumab, and we treated her with cisplatin and trastuzumab, and then she had navalbine, and then she had this beautiful response just to hormones.
I mean, obviously, this is a very unusual case, but it's interesting that this could even happen. She was telling me something about she had to go into the hospital recently for some kind of cardiac thing, and, you know, it didn't turn out to be a big deal and all. And she told me this is the first time she's ever been in the hospital for breast cancer.
That's correct.
And it wasn't even about the breast cancer, is that right?
That's correct.
She managed her 100% as an outpatient for 13 years with mets.
I think she had a portogram and they saw a clot at the end of the port, so the cardiologist felt compelled to Coumadinize her, and it was nothing. I mean, it was just really a sheath. And
so let's focus on what's happened in the last couple of years and how you've dealt with some of the new things that are happening with her.
Well, we decided that we were going to just keep her on hormones as long as we could keep her on hormones. So she had this 7-year response to Farostan. So then we went to Femara, then we went to Faslodex.
All the while keeping the trastuzumab going.
And we kept the trastuzumab going. So this lady has been on trastuzumab now since about 1996. She relapsed very quickly after her bilateral mastectomies, and so just about a year later, she went on to the pivotal trial. And most recently, we actually elected to continue the Herceptin and also treated her with Xeloda and Ticurb. And she was put on that combination May 29th of 2007 and continues on that to the present. At this point, her bone lesions have been stable, and the big problem for her has been an acneiform rash that has been very troublesome for her and very problematic.
And I'm assuming this is from the lapatinib as opposed to the Xeloda?
Yes.
What have you seen in terms of side effects with lapatinib?
In different people, we've seen different things. We have one or two people who have had marked liver function test abnormalities, and that's apparently a new finding.
Goes away when you stop the drug?
Yes.
Do you restart the drug?
In the patient that we had this complication, she really didn't want to go back on it. She also had acneiform rash, and she had some diarrhea. So I think we've only had one, perhaps two, liver function abnormalities. Rash, except in this lady, has not been a problem. And this lady is the patient who's done the very best of all my patients on lapatinib. Diarrhea has been a very troubling complication in about three patients who refused to go back on the drug.
Did it respond to antidiarrheals?
No.
How bad was it?
It was quite bad. I mean, 10, 12 stools per day.
Did you try dose reduction or?
We tried everything. We tried dose reductions. We tried interrupting and restarting. And these patients have just refused to go back.
Any other issues with the lapatinib?
Not really.
What have you seen in terms, I don't know if you used enough of it to actually get a feel for the efficacy and also the issue of brain mets? Any sort of clinical anecdotal feel about those two issues?
Well, in terms of brain mets, we participated in a brain metastasis study with lapatinib, and we had about three patients on. I don't know that any of them derived significant benefit. One of the other patients that you interviewed has brain metastases.
Right. And she's had a year response. Amazing.
She's had a year response, and she had very bad disease in the past, and she's on single-agent lapatinib.
Right. I guess the Xeloda was stopped, her toxicity, hand-foot, kept the lapatinib going.
Yes. To be fair, when the drug came out, all the worst actors went on the drug. So everybody who had failed 5, 6, 7 lines of Herceptin-based therapy were going on the trial. Most of the patients were already exposed to Xeloda. So we don't have any Xeloda-naive patients in the practice. So the drug really didn't get a fair shake.
This lady sort of is an extreme example of this whole issue of how long do you keep trastuzumab going. Obviously, she's developed a track record that nobody would have, but you know, there was so much debate about that, and then lapatinib came out and sort of, you know, do you still have patients like her where you're just keeping the trastuzumab going through multiple lines of therapy because she did so well earlier on?
I have several of these patients. I have another one who's now 10 years with bone metastases, and she refuses to come off treatment. I have another with liver metastases who's now at about 8 years.
And we know, at least according to the trial data, that people are going to be developing relapses in spite of receiving adjuvant trastuzumab. Have you had any patients like that?
I have 4.
And how do you determine whether to restart the trastuzumab or use lapatinib?
I govern it by the time after cessation of trastuzumab. If it's within a year, then I would move directly to Ticurb. As it turns out, of the 4 patients, we have a trial for adjuvant trastuzumab failures. There are very few patients who have been entered into that
trial. That's interesting. What's the study?
It's a chemotherapy plus lapatinib trial. And of the 4 patients that we've had who relapsed, 2 relapsed in the brain, so we're ineligible. 1 was a man and was ineligible because of that fact. And the other lady was a very complicated patient who was treated with single agent adjuvant trastuzumab because she had a coexistent Epstein-Barr virus infection and a high viral load hepatitis C, and she refused chemotherapy.
The next two patients from Dr. Vogel's practice who met with me have ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease, and after a series of endocrine therapies were treated with chemotherapy and bevacizumab. The first woman is a school teacher who was diagnosed at age 40 in 1996.
She had a modified mastectomy at that time and had 25 out of 36 positive lymph nodes. She received AC followed by docetaxel, chemotherapy followed by comprehensive nodal and chest wall radiation. She had a reconstruction at a later date and opted to have a left simple mastectomy in 1998 prophylactically and had reconstruction at that time. After her chemotherapy, she had an oophorectomy. She was both ER and PR strongly positive, and so she had the oophorectomy and was put on tamoxifen, and the patient herself stopped tamoxifen after 3 months solely for hot flashes. And she did well then until 2004, when she developed a recurrence in bone, and she required some left hemipelvic radiation at that time for bone metastases that were painful, and she was put on Femara as part of a clinical trial, and she also received therotope vaccine at that time. She relapsed relatively quickly. She got about 8 months on that protocol, and then she went directly on to the EFECT clinical trial, randomized to aromicin or Faslodex, and she actually got the aromicin and again got about 7 months out of that, and then was put on Faslodex.
How'd she do on the Faslodex?
After 2 months, she developed liver metastases, and she was then eligible for the Ribbon 1 clinical trial.
So this is a lady now who's developed disease recurrence 8 years, approximately after diagnosis, a delayed recurrence. Just curious about your perspective. You know, there's been a lot of attention on this issue, the long-term history of ER-positive disease. I've heard people make analogies to follicular lymphoma. How do you think it through? How do you integrate the original, you know, risk in deciding when to start thinking about a delayed AI or continuation of an AI for that matter?
I continue AIs in probably the majority of my patients.
You know, it's really interesting. In the last 2 or 3 years, a lot of people are doing that. Why do you think the mindset changed?
Well, the mindset for me changed when the data was emerging that the relapse rate in years 5 through 15 is greater than in years 1 through 5. So when I tell patients that as part of the discussion, when they reach their 5-year period, if they're not having any problems with the drug, then they seem to be more inclined to wanting to continue. And certainly if I have patients with positive nodes, I'm going to actually steer them in the direction of continuation. The patient with a 0.6 centimeter tubular, you know, those patients try to steer away from continuation, rightly or wrongly. Patients with positive nodes, I almost always try to continue on AIs.
So this lady with 25 nodes, if she had presented today, you know, of course she actually didn't even get tamoxifen, but I would imagine that you would have thought a lot about an AI.
I would have, yes, and I would have continued her for maybe even indefinitely.
So she goes on the EFECT study, and then eventually you got to the point where you decided she was not going to respond to hormones, at least at this point, and she goes on Ribbon 1.
Yes. I think that what happened was that we had her on the Faslodex, and she was still having pain. Ribbon 1 was available. We did a workup and were very surprised to find liver metastases. We hadn't re-imaged her liver in a long time. She had had bone-only disease. And with the discovery of liver metastases, even though she hadn't had an adequate trial of Faslodex, we felt that it would probably be better to have her on chemotherapy.
So she goes into Ribbon 1, and that allows choice of chemo.
Correct.
And you chose capecitabine.
I chose capecitabine. In fact, I chose capecitabine in virtually all of my Ribbon 1 patients at that time. It goes along with my basic philosophy of care to try to use the least toxic chemotherapies possible. So she got capecitabine with or without bevacizumab, because there was a 2 out of 3 randomization to bevacizumab or not.
Now, what schedule did you use?
In her, she gets 1 gram twice a day for 14 days, 7-day rest period, and then a return to it.
What do you think about the memorial thing of 1 week on, 1 week off?
I sometimes use that. We've used it in some patients, especially the ones who have genetic aberrations that lead to really marked dose attenuations of capecitabine, DPD questions and thymidylate synthase questions. And I have used the 7-day on, 7-day off schema and have had responses and have done nicely with it.
So what happened? She went on capecitabine and something, either Avastin or placebo.
Correct. And as I said, I started most of the patients in Ribbon 1 on capecitabine, and she's the one that has had the longest response and continues on the regimen now approaching 2 years.
And what's going on in terms of side effects and toxicity treatment?
Nothing. She has very little in the way of side effects. She's had none of the problematic issues from the Avastin. No hypertension.
Actually, she told me was that her blood pressure does go up, but I wasn't clear whether it was truly hypertension, because she said she's able to calm herself down and bring it down. So I don't know if it's Avastin hypertension or anxiety hypertension. I thought it was interesting, the idea of oncology office hypertension. I don't know how often that happens, where patients just get upset and, you know, just let them calm down and their blood pressure comes down.
Most of my patients, or a good percentage of my patients, the ones who are 3-month, 6-month, 1-year visits, they get apprehensive a day or two before they come for their visit. They come in, they're hypertensive, and I call it to their attention and tell them to go take their blood pressure next time they go to the grocery store if they are not hypertensive.
So when you've had your patients on the Ribbon 1, have you been able to guess, like in this woman or your other patients, whether or not they're really getting bevacizumab?
Well, my guess is she's getting it.
Because she's doing well.
I could be wrong, because I have patients who have been on capecitabine for 4 years for metastatic disease without bevacizumab.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When capecitabine first kind of, we started hearing a lot about it, it seems like it was around 2001, 2002, there was the XT study and all this, and what we saw in our patterns of care was some initial reluctance to use it for quite a while, and then, you know, a big swing towards it, and now a lot of question marks because Bev's around, and the issue of CAPE and Bev. What's your take on that?
Well, I continue to use a lot of capecitabine. I think it's a wonderful drug. I've had beautiful responses, even in patients with pretty bad disease. The big swing, I think, was because when the doctors started using it, they might have been using package insert dose. They got burned really badly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
By toxicity, and said, well, I'm never going to use this drug again.
You know, there were also people, and we were hearing this in our colon series too, you know, questioning, is this some kind of financial issue? You know, it's not an, you know, infusion, et cetera, et cetera. But it was interesting how, as investigator after investigator like you, Eric Weiner, a lot of other people started just hammering, at least in our interviews, how useful capecitabine was as a palliative agent. We started to see the docs in practice change what they did. And now what we see is a real issue of, are they going to use capecitabine with or without Bev versus a taxane Bev?
Well, my gut feeling is most of my Ribbon 1 patients, after they progressed on capecitabine with or without Bev, they had the option of going on open label Bev with whatever. And so I chose Abraxane as my drug of choice, and most of these patients have responded to Abraxane open label bevacizumab and done very nicely on that regimen. I'm more impressed with that regimen than I am with capecitabine plus bevacizumab. And, you know, I'm very aware of the Excalibur data, and there was an interesting sublight on that one, and that was that the estrogen receptor positive patients seemed to do better than the estrogen receptor negative patients with capecitabine and bevacizumab.
Which, of course, is what this lady is ER positive, so
correct.
She may fit into that. Not to get too far off the topic, but you mentioned Abraxane Bev. How do you stack that up versus paclitaxel Bev?
Well, wherever possible, I use Abraxane in preference to paclitaxel. I think that there is a possibility that Abraxane may actually be a superior way of giving paclitaxel. And you get around the longer infusions with paclitaxel because of all of the premedications. I think it's probably better tolerated.
Neuropathy, any thoughts on that? It's been questioned, does it go away quicker? Is it less severe? Any thoughts on that?
I've been using relatively low doses of Abraxane in my patients.
What
I've been using 100 per meter.
Weekly, 3 out of 4?
Weekly, 3 out of 4. The data would appear to show longer durations of disease control with somewhat higher doses. I believe 150 per meter looked better in terms of duration of disease control.
What do you think about this issue of efficacy? When I first heard it, you know, about the spark and all this stuff, I was like, I don't know, maybe. And, you know, then there was the pivotal study, but that was Q3 weeks. But then when that randomized phase 2 that Gradishar presented, you know, about a year or so ago, you know, kind of looking like maybe it was more effective than docetaxel, that kind of got my attention. What did you think about that?
Yeah, that trial is being repeated here in the United States, and that would certainly be very interesting if indeed it showed the same results.
This would be phase 3, though, randomized? This
is a phase 3 randomized, as I understand it. We elected not to participate, but it's a trial that really needs to be done. My gut feeling, I think the science is compelling, and I think the preliminary data are very interesting, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if nab-paclitaxel proves to be superior to paclitaxel, and I wouldn't even be surprised to see it superior to docetaxel.
So getting back to this lady, did she have an actual objective response?
Oh, yeah. Her liver got dramatically better, and of course it's very difficult to tell anything about bone response.
Tumor markers?
Her markers have never been helpful for us.
Are you using circulating tumor cells?
I'm playing.
I've been skeptical about that for a long time, and now I'm starting to get interested.
Well, me too, but I still don't know what to do with it.
What I think is it sounds like I've been hearing lung cancer and stuff like this, that now maybe the technology is going to come out to do more than just say they're there, to look at marker, you know, things on the tumor cells or something. I don't know, that, you know, maybe do more with it than just what it's been done up to now.
I'm sure that they're going to be doing more with the technology, but I'm still struggling with the nitty-gritty day-to-day. How do you use it?
Right.
You know, when you see patients, as I do frequently, with widespread metastatic disease with zero values, we have a lot of them.
Right.
And then we do have some patients, very difficult to figure out, the bone-only patients, where maybe their other markers are bouncing around and not particularly predictive. So I've been using those, the circulating tumor cells, in a couple of patients. It looks like it might have been valuable, but I really still don't know how I feel about them, and I don't routinely use them.
What about tumor markers? Do you use them, and what fraction of patients are they useful? You said in this woman it wasn't. What fraction is useful?
I think that tumor markers are probably useful in about 75% of patients with metastatic breast cancer. Probably about 75% are going to have elevations. So maybe of those, you're going to find 50% where they really seem to be predictive of what's going on. The other 25%, maybe they bounce around a bit too much. But it's certainly easier to do that than it is doing a bunch of imaging studies.
Now getting back to NAB, clearly, if we start seeing greater efficacy, that's going to be something that's going to get a lot of attention. But I've been surprised that people don't focus that much on the issue of avoiding steroids. And we found in our patterns of care, actually, that maybe a quarter of oncologists use steroids in NAB. I mean, we've been trying to sort of bring that message home that that's not what's been done in these trials. But I met your patient, and I was fascinated by the fact that she told me she gained 35 pounds when she got, she got paclitaxel bevacizumab, and boom, gained 35 pounds.
Right.
Can you talk just briefly about what happened to her? And then now she's on NAB, Bev, no weight gain, no steroids. I mean, you know, it's obviously not an easy situation, but at least in terms of that problem, which was really disturbing. And I think she was also not just so much worried about the cosmesis, but is this going to be, you know, people now have heard about weight gain and cancer progression. So what happened with her?
She had, again, bad disease. She has bone disease, and she's got liver metastases as well as nodal metastases. And we offered her involvement in Ribbon 1, and she said, well, can I get bevacizumab without being on Ribbon 1? We checked with her insurance, and they said yes, so she elected to do that. She went into a very nice remission with paclitaxel and bevacizumab, and then as most of our patients, they do so well for so long, they say, listen, enough is enough, I'm tired. And they just get worn out from the frequent trips to the doctor, the toxicity, the neuropathy.
Were you aware of her weight gain?
Yeah.
What was your thought about it, and what was your response to it? Because I was wondering if that was part of the reason she was feeling so fatigued. I mean, 35 pounds on her, she's a small woman, was a lot of weight.
Yes, it was. I just felt it was probably one of the side effects of the steroids. And at that point in time, nab-paclitaxel was just really coming around. And we just decided we had to give her a break. And so we put her back on hormonal therapy, but were unable to maintain the remission. And so when it came time to put her back onto something, we put her back on nab-paclitaxel, which she tolerated much, much better.
I want to ask you, since we've already delved into the world of, you know, chemo and Bev, et cetera, and capecitabine, where does Ix fit in?
Ixabepalone, I really don't know yet. Again, this is another situation where ixabepalone plus capecitabine is one of the mechanisms for approval. I mean, ixabepalone is approved as a single agent as well. Most of my patients have been exposed to capecitabine, so it's been single agent ixabepalone. I've used it in 3 patients. One patient progressed rapidly. A second patient also progressed but was feeling poorly on the drug, and I don't know whether it was her progression or she's Spanish-speaking, and it was a little difficult to tease that out. And the other patient was on it for about 6 courses, and at the end of 6 courses, she said that she's been a trooper on everything else, and she just couldn't continue.
What was it that was bothering her? What was the problem?
I think it was a combination of neuropathy, myopathy, extreme fatigue, and so she came off the drug. She said she just couldn't continue on it.
What's your take on the clinical research data available with the drug? What are you kind of expecting to see from it, both in terms of efficacy and side effects?
The side effect profile that I've seen so far has been a bit more difficult, and I am waiting to see weekly data. And I'm sort of hoping that maybe by cutting the dose and giving it on a weekly schedule, that maybe there might even be improved efficacy and maybe decreased toxicity. So that's what I'm hoping for. As far as the efficacy, I think efficacy is there. The FDA said it was there. ODAC said it was there. The drug is active. Looking at the triple negative subset data from their pivotal trial, it looked promising in the triple negative population, so that might be a niche that should be further explored.
The last patient presented in this fellow's rounds is another woman with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, a woman who now seems to be responding in the brain and liver to single-agent capecitabine.
She's a very interesting, very quiet, soft-spoken nurse who had stage 4 disease at diagnosis back in 2003. And she was managed for the first 2.5 to 3 years with sequential hormones, Femara, Zoladex, also on the Theratope vaccine trial, Faslodex plus Zoladex, Aromacin Zoladex. And finally, she had liver and bone metastases, so we treated her with a clinical trial that we were doing at the time, trying to find a tolerable dose of docetaxel plus Zoloda. And she got a good response but had toxicity from that combination as anticipated, and then had a very good year and a half on tamoxifen plus Zoladex. So the next thing that we did when she progressed in May of 07 was we put her on high-dose estrogens and Zoladex. And we're submitting an abstract to San Antonio on our high-dose estrogen data. Unfortunately, she didn't respond.
How many patients do you have now?
We have about 30.
Wow. And what kind of response rate are you seeing?
It's about 20%.
How about stable disease?
Well, I'm saying 20% probably prolonged stable disease and responses. But the high-dose estrogens was generally used, I would say, greater than fifth or sixth line systemic therapy and probably greater than fourth or fifth line hormonal therapy.
Now, you've been telling me about this for years. Matter of fact, the last time we did this, you presented a patient who received high-dose estrogen. Right now, what kind of preparation do you use? Because I know it's kind of been an issue in the past. Where do you get it?
Well, this is easy, actually, and it's going to be easier after San Antonio because Matt Ellis is going to be, I think, presenting his data. He has a randomized trial of 30 milligrams of estradiol versus 6 milligrams.
And what have you used?
I have used the 6 after Matt and I shared a program in Brazil, and he told me that the 6 milligram dose was just as good as the 30 milligram dose. So I started using the 6 milligram dose. I have a patient that we saw today who is responding beautifully in liver, lung, and bone. She's having a beautiful response, and she's at 30, and she's having so little in the way of side effects that both of us decided, even when we knew that 6 may be as good, not to rock the boat.
So, you know, I hearken back to, God, I don't know, I think it was 1975. I don't know, it was a long time ago. I think it was New England Journal comparing tamoxifen to DES, the original study. What dose did they use there?
The DES was 15.
In that study?
In that study, but DES you can't get unless you get it compounded. So we were compounding
right.
The DES for quite a long time. But then after speaking to some of the hormonalists, we found that 30 milligrams of estradiol would be considered an equivalent dose.
And so you just get that out of a pharmacy?
Yeah. You use 5 tablets 3 times a day. They come in 2-milligram tablets, and so you get 30 milligrams.
What have you seen in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Well, the major side effect that we have is in patients who have a uterus, and that becomes a problem because they bleed. And this current lady that we have who's responding so beautifully, I spoke to her gynecologist. He did a D&C. They get endometrial proliferation. And so he is now using progestins intermittently to slough her uterine lining.
I wonder what that does in terms of the tumor.
Don't know.
It's amazing.
We also have another responding lady who developed rather significant pedal edema, you know, like 12 pounds worth of pedal edema. And when we cut the dose from 30 to 6, that improved very significantly and improved her quality of life.
I think the lady that I interviewed before talked to me about increased libido. Is that something you're seeing?
Yes. We have a couple of patients who have volunteered information that they've noticed an increase in libido.
Okay, so now getting back to this lady, so you tried her on the DES, what happened?
She didn't respond, so we were working her up to put her on the Ribbon 2 trial, which is chemotherapy of a number of different types, with or without bevacizumab, and lo and behold, it's my policy if I'm going to put somebody on bevacizumab to at least take a look at the brain to make sure that they don't have brain metastases. And she had asymptomatic brain metastases. They were relatively small, and so she became ineligible for that trial. Now, you recall that she never failed docetaxel and capecitabine. So being off protocol, we decided to treat her with capecitabine. Then we were faced with, what do you do with asymptomatic brain metastases? So I was toying with the idea, well, you know, we could always do Gamma Knife. I think she had maybe 3 very small lesions. And I said, these lesions aren't really bothering her. Let's just see what happens if we give her capecitabine alone and not treat her with brain radiation of any sort. The precedent for that really would come from an old study by Dutsu Rossner back in the 1980s where he used CMFVP in patients with brain metastases who had not been radiated, and found a very definite response rate. So it appears as though the blood-brain barrier is not necessarily intact in these patients with brain metastases. So we've treated her with capecitabine and watching her brain very closely, and her first MRI of the brain showed disappearance of, I think, one of the nodules, stability of another. And we're waiting to re-image her brain. She continues asymptomatic. Her liver is improving. Her markers are going down. So she's on single-agent capecitabine for bone, liver, and brain metastases.
And again, getting the regimen that you described before, a gram twice a day.
1 gram twice a day for 14 days with a 7-day rest period. She has no side effects at all and responding beautifully.
You know, it's interesting, too, because you said you were thinking about Bev in this situation. Would you ever consider it in the future? And I hearken back, we now have, you know, we're doing whatever, thyroid, head and neck, just everything now. But now we're doing malignant glioma update. And here's this data there with Bev. Where do you think that's all heading?
I treat patients with brain metastases with bevacizumab. I certainly tell them that it's supposed to be a no-no, that you're not supposed to do it, that there could be catastrophic consequences. But we're usually dealing with catastrophic patients. And we haven't had much of a problem, although my most recent patient had resected brain metastases. And after a dose of bevacizumab, she did seize. And I don't know whether it was related to that or not. She had already had a craniotomy. But we've treated, I think, 2 or 3 patients with brain metastases, and the others have not had problems.